Heavenly King, Comforter, Spirit of Truth, who art everywhere present and fillest all things, Treasury of good things and Giver of life, come and dwell on us and cleanse us of all impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Thank you again for your interest, and apologize starting for I guess some of the roughness that is in these. I'm not yet skilled enough with the use of the software to bring a better polish to these presentations, and some of the struggles that are going on. This is a learning process for me in on this technical side, even as it is hopefully a pleasant process of learning for you, and as we are exploring what the Orthodox Church teaches and believes and practices. In our previous session, we talked about the distinction between facts and truths, and used a couple of examples, the grenade in the foxhole and how many blind men, as ways of kind of coming to grips with the distinctions between facts and truth, and deciding that that facts are things that are found in time and space, that are observable and are functionable as reason, they're grist for the mill of the scientific method, whereas truths are on one level observable from facts, but on the other level both support and transcend facts, and primarily they're found both in time and space, and in the extent that truths are found in time and space, they resemble and function as facts, but they go beyond time and space, and that's where the truths come in. We talked about different ways of knowing, experience and education, with experience being direct and education being essentially indirect experience being reported to us reliably from others. The gift of God in giving us the ability to reason, to take this information and to do things with it, to move forward and backward in time, to project out so that we can extend and apply the knowledge that we've gained from it. We talked about how reason is limited to what's observable, and that reason is subject to biases. We talked about a way of knowing that comes from God Himself in the form of revelation, and here again, revelation being a presentation of God Himself and presenting us with truths that are not subject to test, and that accepting them as they are, which is the only way to receive them, they then can function within the realm of reason, but are beyond the ability of reason to verify. And of course, through this, we also have an entryway into the meaning of faith itself, which is, St. Paul writes, is the evidence of things not seen. We talked about God's revelation through theophanies. We talked about philosophy and theology as ways of knowing, and their parallels that are drawn between philosophy and theology along the terms of the distinctions between facts and truths, that philosophy is essentially a reason-grounded mode of thinking and of understanding, which works well for us when we keep it within the bounds of what it's suited to operate on, and that theology does not is not mutually exclusive of philosophy. Indeed, there's a great deal of crossover, but the ground primarily for theology is in the realm of the revealed truths and talking about things that are beyond the ability of reason. And so that theology, this study of God, is a good match for, but also supersedes the operation of philosophy and the examination of the experimental or experiential sciences. And that we began to speak of a theologian not so much as one who has studied and completed a course of training, so much as, in the Eastern Orthodox point of view, as a man who is one who prays, who draws close to God in prayer, and with that lives a life that is one of leaving the world behind and coming into the presence of God, and in this way, coming into contact with these truths that are revealed by God and being able to present them to the rest of us, not only in the intellect, but also in the emotions and in the senses. So these are important ways for us to understand that we can know certain things that are beyond the realm of science, and can know certain things that are beyond the realm of philosophy, and yet they don't simply become, you know, wild guesses. They're not a reach in the sense of we believe them even though it's insane to believe. So these are important ways of distinctions of knowing. And simply because some in the scientific realm or some in the philosophical realm don't accept the premises from which we proceed does not, in my opinion, invalidate those things that we know from God and those things that have come to us through the insights and the teachings and the life experiences of the people who have gone before us, men and women alike, the fathers and mothers of the church, if you will, who have embraced a way of life and a way of understanding that shows us the reality of these truths in a way that defies reason alone, that defies observation alone, and yet nevertheless can strike a chord within us that reveal to us this contact with God, this contact with truth, by which we can then set our course and steer our way through the many obstacles and challenges that life presents us in a way that is pleasing to God, in a way that is beneficial to others, in a way that as well is beneficial to the salvation of our souls. I want to move on at this point and talk about what might be described as special ways of knowing, which then will set us up for kind of the launching off from this exploration we've been making of the cultural formation that particularly those of us who are converting to the faith or have converted to the faith from a Western culture have to come to grips with, and some other, the Eastern cultures too, Eastern European cultures, because increasingly these days with the advent of electronic media, the internet, radio, television, even print resources now reaching into parts of the world that previously had been unreached, there's an increasing level of exposure to Western modes of thinking and Western ways of appreciating the world, and they have their influence in places that were previously closed to Western thought in many respects. So it's not a uniquely Western position anymore, because that position of the West has spread around the world. But we've been looking and considering what it is that has shaped our thought and in some cases might trigger a response that says, oh yes, I know that, when in fact we don't know it, or this is new to me, and so we're inherently cautious about this new information and how we should respond to it and how we should process it, so that we can be prepared then to launch and go into a more detailed examination of, in hopefully a systematic way, of the things that the Orthodox Church teaches and believes and practices. These special ways of knowing relate back in part to what we said previously about theology, because there's two key terms that will then give rise to two more key terms. Sorry about that. In this last part of the consideration of special ways of knowing, and these terms, the first two initial terms are important. One is theologia or theology, and the other Greek term is oikonomia or economy. Now, theologia is the study of the divine. We've talked about that, the study of God. The roots of the two words there, theos and logia, to study God. Economy is essentially household management, and it derives from the word oikos, which has to do with the world, it has to do with the cosmos, it has to do with the household. And so in a sense, economia, or the divine economy, is how God manages his house, which is to say the cosmos, everything that's created. And so we find ourselves in a place where we cannot say or even think anything about God that he has not revealed. Okay? And this in itself tells us something about God, in that God always acts in an economical way. Okay? There's nothing wasted. There's nothing without purpose. We don't have the full picture, but we have enough, which is an economical way of providing information to us. And yet it's not everything. So we recognize, on the one hand, we have something, but we don't have everything. And there's nothing by chance, nothing wasted about all that. We cannot know the Father without the Son, Jesus Christ, and we cannot know Jesus as the Son of God without the Holy Spirit, who reveals this truth to us as well. And so what we have is a package here, that there is a connection between theology and this divine economy that we have to take into account. And in this, we have a couple of other minor terms that are significant. We have transcendent and immanent. And the word transcendent basically means unknown and unknowable. It's so far above us, so high that we can't grasp it. Immanent, on the other hand, is something that's present throughout the cosmos, and it's inherently in contact with us, and it's knowable, it's perceivable, or at least the doorway is open to that. And the importance of this particular way of knowing, of theologia and economia, is that through this combination, the transcendent God of theologia becomes immanent by his economia. In other words, the God who is unknown and unknowable, and therefore unstudiable by reason alone, because he is so utterly different than we are, and so incredibly high above us, nevertheless draws close to us by his action, and is present to us by his economy. And so we have a way of knowing in that particular regard. From this comes two aspects of going back now to this discussion of theology. Two more key terms that in particular set the stage for us to understand things from an Orthodox point of view. And the first would be called cataphatic theology, and I'll spell that for you in case you want to write it down, just in case you're making notes. K-A-T-A-P-H-A-T-I-C. Cataphatic theology might be described as positive theology. Okay? And it usually proceeds by use of affirmation, statements about something that is. So we would be saying in doing cataphatic theology, God is statements. God is good. God is light. God is truth. God is love. God is patience. God is merciful. Cataphatic theology allows us to have knowledge of God, but we, at least from an Orthodox point of view, we say that this knowledge is imperfect. All knowledge has as its object that which is. That makes sense. God is beyond all that exists, so God, therefore, cannot be perfectly known in this way, because it's impossible to describe in positive statements God, because it's impossible for us to get all the way around him, if you will. It's like if you've ever had the experience as a kid taking silly putty and going to the funny papers and the Sunday papers, the color supplement, and kind of spreading that silly putty out, and you can lift an image up off of that, and you can get a good image that comes off of that, but you don't have enough silly putty to do the entire page. And in a sense, cataphatic theology is an attempt to take a finite mind and wrap it around an infinite God. You can't do it, and the attempt makes your brain hurt. So we can know some things about God, but we can't know everything about God. We can't know God perfectly through cataphatic theology. If you're familiar with set theory, it would be to say that there is a set that contains the attributes of God, and then there's another set that contains everything that is not God. And the problem is that the subset, you know, which is a subset of the other? We would have to represent in one sense the set of the attributes of God as either being a completely separate set or one that only tangentially contacts a set of what is not God. And there's so much out there that is not discernible, because our operation, the ability to reason, the ability to use philosophy, the ability to use the scientific method, operates in the set of what is not God. It's you know, it's kind of like being inside the box and trying to think beyond the box, and you have no idea what's outside the box. And to the extent that maybe you know a little bit of something of God has penetrated inside the box, we can know that. And that's really what the Orthodox perspective is. The second term, negative theology, which has as its formal title apophatic theology, A-P-O-P-H-A-T-I-C. Apophatic or negative theology proceeds using negations. God is not statements. God is not evil. God is not created. God is not limited. God is not changeable. Things like that. And in using this approach, in order to approach the God who is beyond all that exists, it's necessary to deny all that is inferior to him, which is all that exists. So we approach by ignorance, unknowing, the Greek term agnosia, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, and by another Greek term, catharsis, by cleansing and by purification. And this cleansing takes place on both an intellectual level and on a spiritual level. And it might be if you pictured, if you know what a parabola is, and a parabola with a, it's a curve that descends down like a cone, except it has a rounded edge, not a sharp edge like a cone typically would have. But if you picture this thing coming down and making a curve at its bottom and then rising back up again. And if we were in class, I would draw this for you. It'd be easier to see that. But you picture this cone coming down, and everything underneath that is the set of not God, and everything above that curve is the attributes of God. And so what we have is a penetration into the set of not God. What is God? This is the immanence of God coming into operation now. And so we can know some portion of it. We can know that portion of the curve that we can perceive. But again, because we're finite and God is infinite, we can't perceive the entire curve. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that is beyond the realm of our ability to operate on. And so that sets us up in this case here of the things describing this in terms of what is not. Again, going back to John Meyendorf, Father John Meyendorf, in his work Byzantine Theology, he has a statement in which he says, by saying what God is not, the theologian is really speaking the truth, for no human word or thought is capable of comprehending what God is. One of the things that this sets up for us is this is the last, I think, of the $5 words at this point in the presentation, is an antinomy. That word is spelled A-N-T-I-N-O-M-Y. And an antinomy is in the realm of philosophy, something that simultaneously admits the truth of two apparently contradictory and logically incompatible but ontologically necessary assertions. And there's some illustrations that we'll come to in just a moment of that. An antinomy testifies to the existence of a mystery to which human reason cannot penetrate, and yet which is lived out in the life of faith, and which will not be resolved in this world. And so, this brings us to really, hopefully, an appreciation of a balance and tension in which the Orthodox Christian lives, which the Orthodox faith operates, almost vibrates, between these negative and positive poles, in which we're many times confronted with things that are beyond our ability to reason, and yet operate as accepted truths, as if we could prove them, and I can't think of a good example of an antinomy at this point. Please forgive me, but I think you can see this inherence. On the one hand, we believe X, and on the other hand, we believe Y, and X and Y appear to be contradictory, and yet we live as if both were true. And when we try to follow only one or the other, our lives go out of balance, and they don't work. But when we kind of hold both of them to be true, even though they appear to contradict each other, it then becomes possible for us to be transformed in our being, and to have a life that is satisfactory on many levels, that in which we are improving, and it's that improvement is visible to others and to ourselves. It makes a difference. It makes it, a change, and so this antinomy is an introduction of this state. And it's important for us to be aware of it, because so much of what we come to as we begin to explore specifics in the Orthodox faith leads us into this realm of mystery, of things that are both what they are and yet are more than what they are. In which case, that might be on one level a definition of what the West calls sacraments, what the Eastern Church calls mysteries, as we talked about, the mysteries the why way of proceeding, the why type of main question that Orthodoxy asks, as opposed to the how of the West. Just to be aware of the existence of this as a reality can help us from then encountering this conundrum of X and Y are both true, and X and Y are both apparently unable to exist simultaneously, how then can we proceed? And if we're aware that there are going to be places that we come to where that sort of thing happens, we don't have to stop and shut down and go, well, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Because we've already acknowledged going in, there will be things that happen that don't make sense to reason alone. And so that we have to be equipping ourselves to deal with them in a different way and on a different level. We have kind of two examples, two different categories to illustrate cataphatic and apophatic theology. And these come from two different accounts in the book of Exodus, which is it's the second book in the Old Testament scriptures. And we have two, we have a cataphatic, if you will, a cataphatic theophany of God and an apophatic theophany of God, in which we see, you know, statements about what God is, statements about what God is not, that are not, it's not stated this way in the text of the book of Exodus, but give us some insight both into this operation, how these things function, as well as giving us information about God himself. The cataphatic theophany of God is found in the third chapter of Exodus, where Moses encounters God in the burning bush. This is a bush that appears to be on fire, but the bush is not consumed. And in this, in the fire, we understand that God is light. We understand that God descends to Moses. In other words, God reveals himself through this operation in the burning bush. And so we speak about descending affirmations that come from God in this particular instance. On the other hand, in the 19th chapter of Exodus, when the people of God are gathered and Moses is on Mount Sinai, we have in this text God hidden in the divine darkness that comes down and settles across the cloud that covers the top of the mountain. God cannot be seen, and yet God is known to be present. And in this, Moses goes up to God. This is a situation where it's not so much God revealing himself, although in the overall process of what's taking place there, through the giving of the law, God is indeed making a revelation of himself on several levels. But here, with man going up, as Moses ascends the mountain to go to meet God, we have an ascending negative situation, where before we had a descending affirmative, where God had come down to meet Moses in the burning bush. Now Moses is climbing to meet God in this ascending negative, man seeking God. And this in particular has a great deal of meaning for the Orthodox, because we understand in this, this ascent of Moses into the divine darkness to find God, it's a metaphor for the entire spiritual life that each one of us is called to make, a journey to go into the unknown and there to meet God. And especially for the nous, the mind, in a life of prayer. The mind is meant to be going into the presence of God through the medium of prayer, through the practice of prayer, which is at its core drawing close to God. We'll have more to say about this in a later session. But you know, making this climb, leaving behind the familiar, the comfortable, the world in which our senses provide our information, it's the place we live, and so it's the place we're comfortable with, and going beyond that, up into this divine darkness, there to have God reveal himself to us in that way. So, and that for the Orthodox, that's a very powerful image. A very powerful way of understanding, and therefore a great positive, if you will, on the side of negative theology. I'm sorry, I had to say that. The preferred way of doing theology in the Orthodox sense is the apophatic theology. I have a note here. I can't remember what it is, so I won't go with it. I guess this is as good a place as any to try to get into it. A distinction between the essence of God and the energies of God, and this kind of relates back to the whole process of God's revelation of himself, and into theology and the apophatic and cataphatic theologies. And to try to summarize this very quickly, what we have is a situation in which the Orthodox will say that the essence of God is unknown and unknowable. Again, this is a definition of transcendence. It is so totally, so utterly different that there aren't even words to describe it. We can't, in many ways, we couldn't, I mean, you could be in the presence of God and not even perceive it. You would simply perceive a disconnect, an unknowingness. You know, the best you could hope for is an awareness that there is something or someone or, you know, some aspect here that is so alien to us that we don't even know what it is. And this is the essence of God. We cannot know the divine essence. But what we can know are the energies of God. And these, if you think, there's some analogs in the material world, things that science is aware of, that begin to give us perhaps some degree of appreciation for this distinction. On one level, it would be simple to say we cannot know who God is, but we know something about God because of what God does. There's another way of looking at this and think about this in that there is power in this reality of this interplay of doing arising from being, of energies coming from essence. And if you think of this is not a good example necessarily. It's simply the best one I can think of. But if you consider electricity running through a wire. And you may know that movement of electricity through a wire, this energy passing through a material substance, usually a copper wire, sets up an electromagnetic field around the wire, and that field is not present when the electricity is not passing through the wire, but when it is coming through, it'll change the point of a compass, the way it turns. You can actually use that. The reality of that presence of that electromagnetic field to in turn generate electricity, although it's not wouldn't be an economical way of doing it. But if you think about it, it's the reverse of that is actually how electricity is typically generated, in that you take a magnet which has its own electromagnetic field and you move a wire through it, and that sets up a current flow. And so electricity comes out of generators in which wires and are moved in, armatures of wires are moved inside magnetic fields to create an electrical current. And so the reverse is true as well. And this is one reason why the analogy is not a good analogy, because it works both ways. But, and maybe another way, something that science has acknowledges exists but doesn't know what it means, and therefore is very reluctant to make any statements about its actual meaning and purpose, although there are some people who have done a great deal with it, not necessarily always good, not necessarily always supportable, but in the same way that you can find this electromagnetic field around a wire bearing a current, there's something sometimes called a Carillion field around a human being, that there is this energy field that is around us, and when you're dead, it's not there, but what a living person will show this off, and there are certain ways that it can be tested and demonstrated. Now, why it's there, no one knows. What its purpose or function is, if any, no one knows. It's simply one of those things that science has come up on the doorstep of and says, yes, there is this field that exists around human beings when they're alive. And so what Orthodox theology says is that the essence of God, while unknowable, God's being is unknowable. There are things that God does, and we can perceive that as coming from God, and yet not being God, yet transmitting information about God, transmitting grace, transmitting, and we'll have more to say about grace later, but communicating information primarily to us from God without bringing us into contact with God himself, which has a whole set of requirements and a whole set of hazards to go with it. And so this is something as well that we'll probably come back to as we start working through specifics of the Orthodox faith and teachings and practices. But I wanted to at least introduce the concept that the essence of God is unknowable, and the question of essence will come back into certain considerations as we talk specifically about doctrines about God and about human being. And then this concept of energies, the uncreated energies of God, and it's important to stress at this point that it's uncreated energies we're speaking of, because it's not something that God made. It's not an energy as we would typically associate energy in the material world in which we live, but rather this is something that is inherent to the being of God, as that Carillion field is inherent to the being of human beings. And it's a form of communication, so much so that its description, if you were to read the theological works in Greek, there's a word, and the word for word in Greek is logos, and logos has a connotation that speaks about our Lord Jesus Christ as the second person in the Trinity, we'll go in more into this when we reach the point of discussing the doctrine of the Trinity. But for example, if you're familiar with the first chapter, the first verses of the first chapter of the Gospel according to St. John the Theologian, in which he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Every time in the English text, "Word" appears in that, it's logos or one of its conjugations in the Greek text. So they're all this reference to Jesus Christ as the Word of God, the Son of God as the Word of God, uses this term logos, and the term for the energies is logoi. So it's a word that's incredibly closely related to logos. So we see that there's this, but it's not. And this, I'm not an expert in this by any stretch of the imagination. If you have questions about this, let me know, and I'll do some additional research, and we can pass that along. But there's a distinction in the Eastern Orthodox conception of the energies of God compared to what the West typically says in its theology about the energies of God, about the operation of grace, about the way that grace is communicated to us. And from what little bit I recall, and I'm willing to speak about here, to say that the Western conception of that goes against, you know, as it goes crosses the boundaries into the realm of the essence in a way that is Orthodox theologians are reluctant to follow. So there it is. That's the presentation on that. For what it's worth, you have that information. Again, write your questions down. You can email me. You can ask me the next time you see me, and we can cover that in more detail as there's need. I think that we'll, you know, as long as obviously if you have questions about it now, great. If you don't, this concept will come back up, and we get into other things. And if that questions occur at that point, that's fine then. So let's take now this, having completed, I think, this initial phase of looking at how we think and why we think the way we think, the ways that we've been shaped, some of the pitfalls and dangers and some of the key concepts to carry forward, let's launch off into the beginning of this exploration of what the Orthodox Church teaches and believes and practices and requires. And I want to start by asking you to consider, and in doing this, I'll state them, and then it probably would be best to stop listening at that point and respond to these three questions, which I've defined as essentially three basic questions. The first of the three basic questions is, why am I here? The second question is, how am I supposed to live? And the third question is, what happens when I die? How would you answer these three questions? Maybe how would you rephrase or rewrite them? Maybe you don't agree that these are the three basic questions, in which case I invite you to propose replacements for one or for all of them. But stop the tape at this point. Stop the playback at this point and consider, why am I here? How am I supposed to live? And what happens when I die? The three basic questions. Why am I here? How am I supposed to live? What happens when I die? As you can probably imagine, there are short answers to these questions and long answers to these questions, and I'll be interested to hear what you had to say in response to each one of those, and I expect that yours will be short answers. But if they're long answers, that's fine too. I'm certainly going to give you long answers as we work through this. But we'll start with the short answers. Why am I here? The answer is to glorify God. We'll talk more about what that means in a moment. How am I supposed to live in union with God? And what happens when I die? What happens when we die is judgment and our entry into eternity. Let's go back and consider the first question. Why am I here? And we said the short answer is to glorify God. To unpack this, I want to talk a little bit about the Orthodox understanding of what's taking place in the whole question of creation. And really there are five divisions to the act of creation, each one of which has meaning and significance for us in our attempt to understand who God is, who we are, and the interactions between us that lead to the short answer to the question that we are here, each one of us is here, to glorify God. Before the beginning, God was, and that's also a statement in the sense that before the beginning, God was. In other words, God is without beginning and without end. And so before there was creation, there was God. God did not come into being with creation, because if he had, then there would be a creator greater than God who called him into being. This is one of the essentialities in the definition of God, in that God is without beginning, God is without end, God is also changeless. It's not possible for God to change, because if God could change, then God could cease to be God, or God could become greater than God, and these are concepts that are meaningless. As well, what is meaningless is the concepts of time and space and matter. Before we have creation, none of these things exist. There, now time and space, or space and matter, makes a lot of sense. God created all the stuff that there is, that would be matter, and the area where that stuff is found is space. Time also is an act of creation, and this will become important later on in some other considerations that we have. So we begin, or actually before the beginning, we have the reality that God exists. Nothing else exists. Only God exists. So in the beginning, and we have this, this is from that phraseology, of course, comes from the first sentence in the first chapter of the first book in the Bible, the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so before there was a division, before we could begin these five divisions of nature, we have a situation where the uncreated God creates nature. And so, in effect, without knowing anything at all really about how this is done, I mean, that's again, we're back to that Western question, how does God create? We don't know. Where did the stuff come from? We don't know. God called it into being. It's one of the areas that our minds are not capable of grasping, is the possibility of how these things can take place. But where there was nothing, now there is something. And Scripture tells us about it in the sense that things are without form and void. And so the first division of the five divisions of creation is the separation of created nature into intelligible or sensible universes. And in the sense of sensible, something that is capable of being perceived with one or more of the senses, sight, smell, taste, touch, hearing. In this, and here the Orthodox world believes that what we have coming into existence first in this intelligible or sensible universe are the nine orders of angels. These are created beings with great powers, and there are, as I say, there are nine orders. I don't remember the names of them. If we want to know, we can. I'll look them up for you and get them to you. There's angels and archangels and cherubim and seraphim and thrones and principalities and powers and dominions. I don't know how many I've named here, and I'm sure that it's probably at seven or eight. I haven't got all nine. The important thing is not so much that the nine, of the nine orders of what they are. And again, there's a limit to what we know about the distinctions within the nine orders, but it's been revealed that there are nine orders of angels which are, as I said, these created beings with great powers, the principal characteristic that they possess is the freedom to choose to obey or to disobey God. And they also are fixed in their knowledge, which is to say they know everything that they are going to know. It's not possible for them to add to their knowledge. They have sufficient knowledge. Is it all knowledgeable? No, because that would put them on a par with God. Is it knowledge beyond our capability? In all probability, yes. Being fixed in knowledge without the possibility of change, once they have exercised their free will, either to obey God or disobey God, they will remain consistent with that choice. In other words, they're not going to change their mind and say, well, I was disobedient before, now I will obey, or I was obedient before, now I will disobey. The nature of the angelic orders is such as that operating with the information that was given to them in their creation, they exercise their free will and are now hereafter fixed in that because they see no reason to change. And we can understand that circumstance because, you know, we ourselves are very much the same way. When we make up our minds about something, we tend to stay with the decision that we've made until and unless someone presents us with information we didn't have before, which shows us why the choice we made was incorrect, why there was a better choice somewhere else, or why this was a poorer choice than other options we could have made. And so there, we, with that new information, we will change our minds. Sometimes it's information, sometimes it's consequences, but we are changeable beings. The angels are not. They're not like us in that particular regard. And so they're going to, having exercised their free will, be consistent and operate consistently with that free will hereafter. The Orthodox understanding is that approximately one-third of these angelic beings chose to follow the greatest of the angels in that particular regard, Lucifer, into rejecting the dominion of God. And this action, Lucifer, whose name means light-bearer, and was the, in one sense, the pinnacle of the created order, at least within the realm of the angelic, the bearer of light, becomes the enemy of God, the accuser of the brethren, who's now known as Satan. These fallen angels are cast out of the heavenly realm. Okay, and so, in fact, the arrival of the demons are more properly described as fallen angels. They possess this capability. They hate God. And because they hate God, they seek to destroy God, if that were possible, and also to destroy everything that is God's, which, of course, is all of creation. And so they are the enemies of all of creation. This will have significance when we get a little bit further down in the course of the divisions. The further understanding is that there are a third of the angels that remain faithful to God, and their leadership was taken by the Archangel Michael, together with the other archangels, Gabriel, and now here again, the list is eluding me. Again, if it becomes significant, we can look it up. And the third are kind of, you know, neutral. We don't really know a whole lot about this, and we're cautioned against too much speculation in this realm as to why things are the way they are, as to what these angels will do or not do, what their fate is at the time of the judgment. It's simply an understanding that the key is that all angels possessed sufficient knowledge, sufficient intelligence to exercise their free will. Having exercised it, those who were faithful were faithful, those who were unfaithful were unfaithful, and these things will not change. And that a certain portion followed or acted similarly as did Lucifer in rejecting the dominion of God, and so became the enemies of God and the accusers of the brethren. All this takes place before we get to the creation of the earth, because the second division of the five divisions in creation is a division of the sensible universe into the heavens and the earth. The third division is the separation of earth into a surface in which a portion of that surface is established as paradise. And at the fourth division, this paradise is further divided to bring about the existence of non-human beings and human beings who are different than all the other beings. And the final and fifth division of the five divisions of creation is the division of human being itself into man and woman. We're going to focus primarily on this final division because it tells us about ourselves and tells us something then, you know, as an entryway into our relating to God. And the key element for us in this process is the existence of human being prior to the time when Adam and Eve opted to disobey the instruction God had given them in the garden not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. By the way, there's no evidence in Scripture that it's an apple. That's a popular characterization. It may very well have been an apple. It may not have been an apple. The apple may have gotten a bad rap. It really doesn't matter because, excuse me, it's not the fruit that matters. It's the disobedience. Before the fall, before this act of disobedience, okay, if you look at the process of creation, we see step after step after step whereby things are called into being. The sun and the moon and the stars, the separation of the surface of the earth into the waters and the dry ground, and then the instruction, and these are not necessarily in order. I don't have the order of creation laid out before me on a piece of paper, nor do I have it. I certainly don't have it stored in my mind. But these are things that are taking place through the course of this separation of the universe into these smaller organized portions. With the separation of the dry ground from the waters, then the establishment of the different plants, and then the calling forth of the animals, those that live in the waters, those that live in the air, the birds, and those that that live on dry ground. And all of these things God speaks into being. The only act of creation whereby God acts in a way other than by simply saying, let there be, and you see this repeatedly through the creation account, God says, let there be light, and there was light. Let there be whatever it is that God names, and the next sentence is, and there was this thing called into existence. The one distinction is that when God created human beings, we're told in the creation account, God took the dust of the earth and formed it with his hands, and then breathed his spirit into the nostrils of the being he had formed, and man became a living being. There is in this a distinction. The human being is different than all the rest of creation. And this is a theme that's going to get, it's going to pop up from time to time throughout the scriptures in many interesting and different ways. And the culmination of all this is the incarnation of our Lord Jesus Christ. So man and woman have been called into being. They've been shaped by God, and he's breathed into them, and man becomes a living soul. All the creatures that are established are called to perfect union with God. It's accomplished in a state we call synergy, which is the cooperation of the created will with the will of God. The initial state of creation can be seen as an unstable perfection in which everything in the created universe, and remember the created universe includes both the intelligible and the sensible. And here it's important to distinguish that the intelligible universe might be in another set of terminology called the spirit dimension, or the realm of the unseen, which has reality. It does not have material being. It's not sensible. And in other words, it cannot be perceived by the senses, but that doesn't mean that it's any less real. So we have this division at one point, really the division of created nature into the intelligible, which is to say the angelic and the demonic, and the sensible universe, the material dimension in which we exist. Everything in the created universe, both intelligible and sensible, is in a state of becoming. This is this unstable perfection. And this limitation and this movement of becoming become the domain of the forms of time and space. So, by taking on sensible being, we become limited. We're no longer infinite. And so the domain of space comes into being, and the fact that everything is in a state of becoming, which is to say it's changing, or at least potentially capable of change, we have the establishment of time. The fullness of union through this is not achieved, but the possibility for union has been established. And so created beings still have to grow in love in order to accomplish fully the will of God. Human beings, or created beings in this, and this is more, it's more than human being, although obviously, you know, and of course human beings are a part of this dynamic, a part of this set that exists within the sensible universe. But all created beings have not yet achieved the state of deification, but a certain internal order, a perfection of the creature, which was ordained, which is to say it was established, and is tending towards its end, which is to say deification, or as the Orthodox sometimes speak of, theosis. And we should stop for a moment and talk about what this means. Obviously, deification means becoming divine. And this specifically has a title that's meaningful for the Orthodox. It's the process of theosis, the process of becoming like God. We get hints of this sometimes in the scriptures, particularly in the second psalm, where there's a phrase the psalmist speaks as if God is saying, "Did I not tell you that you will become as gods?" And indeed, if you recall the account of the temptation of Eve by the serpent, that's a phrase that the serpent uses. Did God not tell you that you would become as gods? And he beguiles her into thinking that it's essential for her to accomplish God's purpose to violate God's law. The law that God had given not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Eve becomes deluded listening to this instruction contrary to what God had required, and into thinking that this is an essential step that has to be taken in order to accomplish the purpose of human being, which is to become like God. So we have all these things in operation. This unstable perfection in which everything is in a state of becoming, but has not yet achieved that. There's the necessity for growth and change, so that everything in creation can become more and more like God. This has particular significance for human beings, remembering that we are made differently than everything else in creation. It's the divinely appointed function of the first persons, the first man, for example, to unite in himself the whole of created being, and at the same time reach his perfect union with God, and so achieve the state of deification, which, because it takes place in human being, will be granted to all the rest of creation. Okay? Women are included in this too, Mary. Don't misunderstand. When we say man, we're talking about the totality of human being. Adam and Eve, you know, both were present. They're both essential to the operation of God's plan. Remember, this is that was the fifth division of the orders of creation, the separation of human being into male and female. So when I say man, I'm not leaving women out. This is the old style reference, the non-politically correct style of reference of talking about human being. Man is not a being isolated from the rest of creation. By his very nature, he is bound up with the whole of the universe. And in this, the shorthand way of referring to this is man as microcosm, okay? And if you think about it, the word cosmos is a Greek term that means all of created being. And so to speak of something being a microcosm, it means that it possesses all of the potentialities, it possesses all of the capabilities, it possesses some form of identity which renders it capable of expression of the entire cosmos. And each one of us is a microcosm. Each one of us contains within ourselves whatever it was that God gave to Adam and Eve in order to make it possible for them not only to become like God, but by so doing, bring all of creation into that similar state of transformation and God-likeness. And again, how? Who knows? What does it mean ultimately? Who knows? It's all a mystery. You know, why? Because it's God's desire that this happen so that we can share more fully in this state of union with him so that we can glorify God. So the Greek fathers tell us man was created last in order that he might be introduced into the universe as a king is introduced into his palace. In other words, everything was made in order for us to take up residence therein, and through us to bring the reality of all being into the presence of God, as servants, as stewards, as representatives, as priests, and as kings, to bring forth this reality. How is this possible? And again, this connection between human being and the rest of creation is something that the Apostle Paul writes about in, I think it's in one of his epistles to the Corinthians, in which he talks, or maybe it was Romans, all of creation groans as it bears the state to which it's been reduced because of the sin of Adam and Eve. And they wait, all of creation is waiting for the redemption that has been started by our Lord Jesus Christ on the cross. It's waiting for the day when the curse is removed. It's waiting for the day when the power of sin is no longer operative. It's waiting for the day when death is completely destroyed and no longer has any power. And this is a state that all the rest of creation is not subject to because of its own inherent flaw, but rather because what we have done to introduce this into the operation of all of existence. And so this is kind of a backdoor way of talking about the reality of man being a microcosm, of somehow being representative of and having authority over and power over all of creation. This aspect of being in charge, we see in the creation account, again, before the fall, because when after God creates Adam, he brings all of the animals, you know, and they appear before Adam, and Adam names each of the animals. The animals are called what they're called because Adam chooses their names. And again, their names are representative. So again, this isn't something that carries forward into our world today necessarily, although to a certain extent there is meaning to the names that you know, within its scientific realm. Certainly if only by the scientific names that are given. But Adam, more importantly than what the names actually are, is the fact that you don't name something that isn't yours. And so the fact that God brings all the animals to Adam to name means that Adam is given dominion over everything. He's given dominion over all the animals who are the next order of creation, and he's given dominion over the plants. And indeed, the last instruction at the end of creation, God gives the instruction to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and exercise dominion over all the earth. Now, this doesn't mean that they can use it for whatever they want. And we have to remember that at the time that authority was given, it was prior to the corruption introduced into man and woman, into human being, by the fall, by the decision that Adam and Eve made to defy what God had said. And so everything was set in motion to accomplish the glorification of all creation through human beings, summing it up as microcosm, bringing it into the presence of God. A part of what the Orthodox understanding as to how this is possible has to do with the fact that we're, and again, this is something we're told in the creation account, that man is made in the image and after the likeness of God. There is something inherently God-like in us, not because of anything that we've done, but because God has chosen to make us that way. And there's a number of ways of beginning to, you know, grasp some portion of what this means, but we have to say initially, and we have to acknowledge throughout, that we don't know what it means. We don't know the full ramifications of this aspect of being in the image and after the likeness of God. But it nevertheless directs our lives in a number of significant ways, because it's speaking on one level, referring back to what we've called that unstable perfection, in which we exist, but have not fulfilled, we have not achieved, not completed the task that remains before us in order to become who we're meant to be. Some have described this, and I think the imagery is effective, that being made in the image of God is like being wax into which someone has pressed a signet ring, and then the wax is warmed, and so it takes on whatever emblem, whatever symbol is there in that ring, and then you pull the ring out and you have an impression of that ring. You don't have the ring itself, but you have an image that comes from that ring. And so we bear something godlike in our being as a result of God's action, making us in His image. The challenge for us then is to take the potentiality that, that is created by us by having that image stamped in us and grow into the likeness of God. And in this, the supreme likeness of God is in the incarnation of the second person of God, the Son of God, who is incarnate of the Virgin Mary and takes on all of human nature in, and is born into the world as all human beings are born, although without a father. And He is the perfect image of God, and He is completely identified with us. And so the challenge for us as Orthodox Christians is to take the life of Christ that has been given to us in our baptism, empowered in us by the Holy Spirit, by our chrismation, and bring into reality the potential that is established in us by these two things taking place. And so this is a part of what's going on here. And so again, this is a theme that comes up over and over and over again. And so I want to introduce that this sense of being aware that we are made in the image and after the likeness of God. And the terminology there is significant. In the image, it's something that we inherently possess, and every human being has it. After the likeness implies in distinction from being in the image it's something that's possessed. It's already established, it's already accomplished. But the after the likeness is suggests or implies the necessity for a period of transformation, of growing into what it is that we're meant to possess. So the purpose of man is to glorify God. And in this, supremely, to serve God as the crown of creation. And so we're meant to serve God. And in this we serve as prophets and as priests and as kings. Okay? So we're here to glorify God, to unite in ourselves the whole of created being, to become this microcosm and bring it in perfect union with God through the process of theosis, so that all creation will achieve its intended end of union with God. And we do this as prophets, proclaiming the will of God in the world, in word and in deed, which is what prophets do. They explain what God's will is, and they set it forth. Sometimes they do it by proclamation, which is the normal way that we're associating with prophets. Sometimes it's done by a theater, street theater, where the prophet Jeremiah will take a rotting piece of fabric and wrap it around himself and lay down on his left side in the street and stay there and be covered with mud, as a way of non-verbally depicting a reality that needs to be expressed to people so that they can be aware of what's expected of them with God. In addition to serving God as prophet, we serve as priests. Priests offer sacrifice. And the original intention of establishing mankind as priests would offer a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God on behalf of all of those born on earth. And the other thing that priests do, again, if you pay attention during the Divine Liturgy, you can begin to pick up some of the nuances of what's taking place here, because you'll see at times the priest stands facing the altar. He has his back to the people. And other times he turns and he faces the people with his back to the altar. And what's happening is when the priest is, standing in the same, looking in the same direction as all the rest of the people, he sums up everything, all the prayers of the people, all the reality of their presence there, and offers on their behalf as well as his own behalf sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God, his devotion, his worship, his prayers, his energy, his love, all these things being offered to God. And it's not for himself alone, but summing up everyone that's there. And each one of us, each person standing in church, brings who they are and all that they have contact with. And in such a way, then, all of creation is present through the people gathered in the temple of God, offering their prayers to God, and it all kind of funnels up and through. And the summary of that is the priest, and it's not because of anything inherent in the priest. I'm probably more sinful than you are, In fact, I'm sure of it. But it's rather that we stand in the place of Christ, who, in the reality of his being, having taken the fullness of human nature upon himself and joined it completely to his divine nature, can stand in the place, can stand in the celestial holy of holies and offer a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God, knowing it'll be accepted because he's also God. But, and so the priest in the earthly temples where we gather to worship is a reminder of the reality in the intelligible universe, not in the sensible universe. We are the reality in the sensible universe of the reality of what's taking place now in the intelligible realm, where Christ stands continually before the throne of God, offering the sacrifice that is necessary for the forgiveness of our sins, our deliverance from death, and to complete our transformation through offering the sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God. And in return, he bestows upon us, as God, the blessings that are meant to work for our transformation, our glorification, and through us a salvation of our souls and of all the world. And that's the other thing. When the priest turns and speaks to the people, he's speaking as in the place of God. And when he pronounces a blessing, using a cross or using the gospel book or using his hand to give a blessing to the people, it's not the priest. Priest has no power to do that. I certainly have no capability, no right, no special privilege, no special abilities in order to do that. It's a reminder. It's an expression in the sensible realm, again, of the reality, the deeper and greater reality in the intelligible realm, that God is with us and is blessing us and giving to earth all the blessings of heaven through his people. So we have this very important role, and it's important to note that those who have been ordained in the service of the church as priests are given a gift to serve in that particular format, but every Christian, every Orthodox Christian that's been baptized and chrismated has a responsibility to function as a priest within their household, within their neighborhood, within their life, because they also stand in the presence of God. And there's all sorts of symbolism that'll come up that we'll cover as we move through study of things like the layout of churches and the meaning and significance and purpose of that. That all has to do with our being, you know, possessors of this royal priesthood, a phrase that we hear particularly in the Epistle to the Hebrews. It's not just the ordained clergy. They're meant to be the servants of the people of God. The people of God, every one of them, is meant to be a priest, offering a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God. And if you understand yourself to be a microcosm, that you have been given, being made in the image and after the likeness of God, you've been given the ability to speak on behalf of all of creation and bring that in praise and thanksgiving to God, as well as the other things that are necessary for us to do now after the fall. We all share in this, and it's an incredible and profound and awesome, and in some cases awful, situation to find ourselves in, that we have this ability in our prayers and in our lives to make this offering of sacrifice, the sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving. So we're prophets and we're priests and we're also kings. And what does a king do? But a king rules. And in this particular instance, we serve God, being the crown of creation, being prophets and priests and kings. We concentrate the aims of all existing visible creatures in ourselves. Okay, the king stands at the head of the entire kingdom. He's a representative of every person in the kingdom. And so he unites the kingdom. And in this role, we unite through ourselves all things with God. And thus we keep the whole chain of earthly creatures in a harmonious bond, in a harmonious order. And again, there are circumstances, for example, going back to that example we had of Adam naming all the animals in the garden, before the fall, before man was separated from God, there was no fear of man. In fact, all the animals acknowledged the authority of man. They came and they bowed down before him. You know, he didn't have the claws or the teeth of the tiger. He didn't have the size of the elephant. He didn't have the wings or the talons of the beak of the eagles. But all these creatures that are potentially stronger or potentially lethal to human being subjected themselves naturally to human authority, because it was we were placed in that position by God, and the animals acknowledged our authority over them in obedience to God, as we are also called to be obedient to God. When we disobeyed, our disobedience put the whole kingdom in rebellion, even though they were still loyal to God. And this is why creation groans in that particular regard. And this is also why we see, in certain instances, animals that still maintain some form of loyalty to human being, dogs much more so than cats. I've already talked about dog people and cat people. To a dog, your family; to a cat, your staff. But there are echoes in that of the reality of the dominion that we once had over all the animal kingdom. And the reason why animals fear us now is because we have become corrupt and we have become depraved, and we are no longer, we having rebelled against God, they can't trust us any longer. Or and look at what we've done. I mean, is there any reason to be surprised by that response on their part? The other element, the other aspect that argues about that, is you will see this again and again and again in the lives of the saints, where they're accompanied by a wild animal who accepts their ministrations almost as if that animal has become a pet. Saint Seraphim of Sarov had a bear that protected him and defended him, brought him food, acted as his servant and his protector, and accepted the authority of the saint over him. Why? Because Saint Seraphim had grown in the image and likeness of God so much so that he was approaching that state in which he, as a microcosm, was worthy of the animal's respect, the animal's trust, the animal's devotion, as once had been the case for all the animals to Adam and Eve. There are other saints that have encounters with beasts like lions and tigers that act in a similar way. They have no ferocity. They're domesticated in one sense, but not because they've been trained or tamed, but because they recognize the image and likeness of God in the saint and respond as they would respond to God, as it would respond to Adam before his disobedience and the subsequent corruption of human being. Well, we've gone a long time on this, so we'll leave it here. This will end our second tape session, third session overall. And again, if you have any questions, anything that's troubling or bothersome about it, please don't hesitate to let me know. And I look forward to being with you again on Sunday the 8th. God bless you.